12 midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The film producer, Stephen Evans, has getting on for 20 films under his belt, including The Madness of King George, Wings of the Dove, and The Lujin Defence. With Kenneth Branagh, he formed Renaissance Films, and together they made Henry V, Peter's Friends, and Much Ado About Nothing. Last year saw the premiere of First Night, inspired by Mozart's Così fan tutte. So I assume that amongst your many passions, Stephen, music is one.
Yeah, music is probably, in cultural terms, my overriding passion, yeah.
Did that emerge along with your love of film, or was it always there?
Well, the answer is it wasn't always there, and I, funnily enough, discovered it rather late, because when I was a young schoolboy, aged 5 to 9, I took piano lessons, and then partly the excitement of the sports field and the excitement of the golden age of rock and roll with the Beatles, the Beach Boys, etc., I really took no interest in classical music and until probably my mid-late 20s.
Just tell us how you found your way into film.
Well, I found my way into film. It's a bit of a shaggy dog story. I'm not a great believer in serendipity always working well, but anyway, I was working on the stock exchange. I was a stockbroker, and I'd already developed my love of music, and I had a love of film, and by this time a love of opera and a love of theatre. And I read an article on this guy who was unknown to me, Kenneth Branagh, who was starting his theatre company. I decided to ring him up, and in the end, the only reason I rang him up and got through, because I rang him about 7 or 8 times and he hadn't replied, but in the evening I went to the wrong house, and as a result of that, and probably too much wine, I thought, well, I'll give him one more chance and ring him again, and he replied, and I went to meet him, and my plan was to put some of my own money into probably a theatre festival or something where his company could go along to. And in the end, although I was involved in financing his theatre company, he wanted to do a film, and I went with him. I mean, at that time, he was only 27, but, you know, he was an incredible 27-year-old.
It does suggest that you really are passionate about your passions.
Yeah, I suppose I am. If I get excited about something, I can be led very easily by a carrot, right? So I'm a bit of a donkey in that respect, yeah.
The first music, I imagine, was not necessarily something you played when you were a young pianist.
No, very much not, no. One or two of the easier Mozart sonatas I can have a crack at, but that was it, yeah.
And what's fascinating to me about this is that you feel that the identity of the pianist, well, you recognise straight away if it's certain pianists, but that's quite important to you in the reading of this music.
Well, it is, and the amusing thing is that when I had this idea that I was going to rediscover classical music, I went into this record shop in Cheapside in the city, and it was being played, and I said to the manager, "What's that piece? It's rather wonderful." And he said, "It's Brendel's Sonata in B-flat." So I said, "I'll buy it." And then it got me on a crash course of Brendel, because having got to love it, I then moved on to the other sonatas, the Impromptus, etc. And that's why it's good to have it at the start, because that was the beginning of my classical music journey, if you like.
And you find something very joyous about this Schubert.
I do, and yet I'm not... I mean, I like his symphonies, but I don't play them very much. I'm not a Schubert nut or anything, but I am a Schubert piano nut, yeah. And I'm a Brendel nut as well, in that area.
Thank you. There's a wonderful kind of rippling quality to that music. It all burbles and bubbles, as well as being marvellously melodic as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It is rather fortuitous to kick off your record collection with that particular piece.
The third movement, the Scherzo, from the Piano Sonata in B-flat, Deutsch 960 by Schubert, played by Alfred Brendel. Stephen Evans, you mentioned, or rather I mentioned, First Night, the film which came out not so long ago, and that was really about the whole thing of putting on an opera, wasn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, I had this idea. It sounds a bit sued, but what happened was I'd been watching a French film called La Nuit Américaine by Truffaut, and essentially it was about making a movie. So you had the movie and you had the actors making the movie, and it was about their interrelationships, and it was an example of life replicating art. So I had this idea of doing this through an opera being put on by a bunch of players. And I originally was going to go for Figaro. And then I was talking to my dear old friend John Mortimer. And he thought Così fan tutte would be a better way of life replicating art through the opera. And I followed him on that. And we're all rather pleased with it. Where how good it is for personal judgment.
What must be nice for you in something like that is that you get to know the absolute nuts and bolts of a great score.
That's part of it, actually, and that just comes naturally after playing and talking and discussing. What is actually, quite frankly for me, even more interesting is that you get to understand the opera world, which obviously you don't get to understand that by going to an opera. You are the audience, and that's where you stay, but meeting opera singers, finding how they work, finding the level of competition, finding whether people smoke or not, finding out the petty jealousies, do they find it boring doing Così fan tutte six times in a year, going to a country house opera, seeing the background, what's going on, sitting in the wings, which of course is a different kind of view of an opera. So that aspect, I must admit, I've been thrilled about. It's been a wonderful experience.
Which bit would you like to hear?
I'd like the Suave, which is basically Fiordiligi and Dorabella with Don Alfonso basically singing goodbye to Guelmo and Ferrando as they leave on a ship.
Thank you.
trio Suave Sia Il Vento from Act 1 of Così Fan Tutte by Mozart, and we heard Sally Matthews singing Fiordaligi, Juliette Poschin, Dorabella, Peter Savage, Don Alfonso, with Chamber Dormen, conducted by James Morgan. So that was from the soundtrack of the film First Night. Stephen Evans, you're going to move on to the great romantic swirl of sound in music that is Mahler.
Mahler, to me, is, I suppose, my favourite. Certainly, he's my favourite in concerts because the magnificence of his sound, really, in a perfect world, you'd always be listening to it in a concert hall. I almost immediately fell in love with him, and because he's so complex and has so many layers, it took a period of time to fall in love with him, which is perhaps the best way of falling in love.
When you saw the light, as it were, what do you think were the qualities that you felt you could really identify with in the music?
Well, I'm not sure whether I'm really clever enough to articulate this, but what I think happened with Mahler and myself, if I dare say that, was that Mahler, in my view, still is slightly bent, by which you expect a movement to be going in one direction and suddenly it turns into another. You automatically expect a certain note and you receive another note. And to me, there's that element of surprise, which obviously that ceases after a period of time. And then you see this, well, unbelievably unusual composer that doesn't, in my view, slot in anywhere else. And given that, let's say, Haydn was the grandfather of symphonies, and Mahler, to my mind, more than anyone, changed it and took it to a new level and gave it a greater flexibility, which probably the symphony was lacking at that point.
George Sell conducted the Cleveland Orchestra in music from Mahler's Symphony No. 6 in A minor, the third movement. Stephen Evans, we often deal in adaptations that you have a book and you make it into a film or you make it into an opera. And it's interesting what one feels one can add to it or take away and whether one feels that the original is better. But we're coming now, I think, to a case in point where you feel that the adaptation was better than the original.
Well, exactly. I mean, I really do feel that strongly. Partly, I suppose, because Macbeth is my least favourite Shakespearean play. But I do think that what Verdi does, he adds something to it. And to me, it's that extra bit that obviously Shakespeare couldn't add because he obviously wasn't a composer. And to my mind, I find it much more moving, and the relationship between Macbeth and his wife, very emotional. So, yeah, I do think that Verdi has done that, and also he did it on Schiller's Don Carlo, which is a very good play, played very well in the last few years by Derek Jacobi in the West End, who was in Henry V and worked with Ken. And what I found was, all the time watching the play, was thinking, where the hell's the music? I mean, I really did miss it. So I do think that music is now getting used more and more. It's been used more and more in plays. And I think apart from often making the emotions more accessible to the audience, I think that what it does do, it's a joy for its own sake as wallpapering a wonderful play.
Do you think in something like the Macbeth that it kind of humanises this pretty dreadful subject?
I think it does humanise it, and one or two of the people are pretty dreadful, Lady Macbeth being one of them. And yet, because I think it's partly due to the music that one understands her more than you would just when she's mouthing, if you like, her emotions. When she's singing them, it seems to take on a new force of its own.
Thank you.
I will endow you with the courage to carry through this desperate enterprise, sings Lady Macbeth. Sung there by Mara Zampieri with the orchestra of the German Opera Berlin, conducted by Giuseppe Zinopoli. Vieni t'affretta from Act One of Verdi's Macbeth. Stephen Evans, one of the things that you have to do in your role as a producer, which is sort of hairiest thing, I guess, is that in an ever more difficult world, you have to get the finance together for films. And you've obviously, amongst the many award-winning films you've been involved in, you've often had quite problems. I think Wings of the Dove was one in case.
Well, Wings of the Dove was a very big problem. And we actually had to sell our house as a result of it collapsing once, but fortunately 2 years later it got made, so we were able to have our house back, or albeit a different house, but we preferred the different house, so perhaps it was all for the good. But on this last film we had big dramas during the shooting of it, and we had to during 1 week have a hiatus period where nothing could happen because everyone had to go home, because the money that we thought was there wasn't there. But that's something that I suppose I've got adjusted to, having had a background of being on the stock exchange. So in terms of losing money at the wrong time, I think my stomach muscles over the many years are now slightly adjusted to it, shall we say.
So it's not only a question of the buck stops here, but the buck starts here too.
It does. The buck starts and stops. And basically, the producer's role is essentially to carry the can. So if this movie doesn't do well, the one person who will carry the can is myself. So I better make another one quite quickly in that, if that's the case, but I hope it isn't.
Well, we'll come on to what might be coming next, but let's go back a little bit, because the next one is one of your earliest collaborations with Ken Branagh, and a very successful one, I think, too, which is Henry V.
Yeah, and going back to money, if you like, I mean, I'd met Ken and financed his theatre company, and really my job, as it should be, not being remotely a filmmaker then, my job was to raise the money, and that's what I did. And obviously that was my background, and I was still on the stock exchange when I raised it, which made it a lot more easy than it is now. So Ken wanted to do Henry V, and he explained to me why. The fact that when Olivier did his, Churchill made sure certain scenes didn't happen, like the traitor scene or the siege of Honfleur, because obviously we were at war with Germany at the time, and he didn't want the bad aspects of war to be shown on the film. Ken did an unbelievable job. I then thought, because of my love of music, there's one thing I can do, and that is I can choose the composer. Ken quite sensibly had other ideas, and he wanted Patrick Doyle to do the music. I asked Pat to do, a tape of what he was trying to do, which he did, and quite frankly, I fell in love with it. So my big idea of getting a top film composer, which Pat is now a top film composer, then he was a beginner in this area, and he composed the music, and we were fortunate enough to have Simon Rattle and the Birmingham Symphony Orchestra did the music to the film. And it's done very well, which is great.
The interesting thing here, Stephen, is that one should remember, because it's a very different thing, that the music that Patrick Doyle has written here is to go under some speech initially, isn't it? The Crispin's Day speech.
No, absolutely, yeah. It was Ken's idea, which in my view has proven to be a great idea, is that he wanted the Crispin's Day speech underscored to make it, again, more emotional and more accessible. And I think that he achieves that. And Pat Doyle obviously did a very good job in enabling the speech to sort of rise above the composition below.
So almost, one could say, the music mustn't be too good, if you know what I mean. It mustn't draw too much attention
Absolutely.
To itself.
It's not a war between the voice and the composition, no. So the two have got to blend together, and I think it works well, yeah.
Now, my fair cousin, if we are marked to die, we are enough to do our country loss. And if to live, the fewer men, the greater share of honour. God's will, I pray thee, wish not one man more. Brother, proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day is called the Feast of Crispin. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispin. He that shall see this day and live old age will yearly, on the vigil, feast his neighbours and say, tomorrow is St. Crispin's. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in their mouths as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
That was Patrick Doyle's music for St. Crispin's Day from the film Henry V, with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle, and we heard the voice of Kenneth Branagh. You're an aficionado, Stephen Evans, of the Rossini crescendo and accelerando, aren't you?
Well, this particular piece we're about to hear, I do like the Rossini and the Wagners, their ability, and Beethoven, their ability to produce crescendos, which really make your hair curl.
This one is perhaps, well, I wouldn't necessarily expect it in a petite messe solennelle.
No, well, that's, I think, why it's so amazing.
Well, I mean, as with the Mahler, that unexpected turn.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I first heard it in a church in Paris, and I think it was composed for a salon in Paris, but I think it's better in a church because of the subject matter. But there was only one piano, two sopranos, and the chorus was three people. And yet, because of how Rossini has composed it, you get this marvellous resonating climax, crescendo, and God knows how he does it, but I suppose that's a thing called genius, isn't it? You accept it and love it.
I've always thought it was a rather extraordinary piece. It's kind of, well, of course, especially with the scoring there, which is very unusual, but there's something about it which has a very individual quality.
Well, I think it does, and I think what is so rather wonderful about it is that when Rossini stopped composing operas, that was when he was, 37, and he's written this when he's 74, having done relatively little stuff during that period. And the fact that the genius is alive and well is rather wonderful, and the fact that it's almost, how shall I put it, a prayer to God of a dying man. And I think it's that that gives it a spirituality, whereas if he'd have composed it at his peak, somehow that level of spirituality wouldn't have existed. So I think that it's a very personal piece as well, Michael, yeah, which is great.
The Agnus Dei from the Petite Messe Solennelle by Rossini. And we heard Lucia Valentini Terrani, the mezzo-soprano, with Coro Polifonio de Teatro alla Scala, and Leone Maggiera played the piano, and Vittoria Rosetta the harmonium. We're going to end actually where we began, Stephen, because you talked about your journey towards classical music and film, but before that, how important to you the popular music of the day was.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I was brought up, which, you know, very few people, unless they're similar age to me, have the opportunity of being brought up in the golden age of rock and roll. And one was seeing it happen at the time, whether it was the Beatles, the Beach Boys, the Rolling Stones, and obviously Bob Dylan and a number of other people. So it was a very, very exciting period to be around because new stuff was coming at you every week, whereas nowadays it tends to be existing stuff or marginally formulaic stuff that's coming at you. So it was an exciting period, and hence my choosing Bob Dylan as the last piece.
She Belongs to Me.
Yeah, She Belongs to Me, which is there's no personal reason why I've chosen that. I suppose the personal reason why I've chosen Dylan is, given the geniuses of the classical world, in one area, Dylan is, if you like, 10 steps ahead, because number one, he was a composer, number two, a librettist or lyricist, number three, he sang his own stuff, and number four, he gave the orchestra backing through his guitar and harmonica. And I don't think there's anyone ever in the history of the world who's had all those four elements together and made a wonderful sound. I mean, even today, if you wanted to fill the O2 Stadium next Friday, if you went down on the internet that Dylan was performing, it would be full. You know, it's one of those weird and wonderful things, and it was a privilege to be around when he was playing them for the first time.
She's got everything she needs. She's an artist, she don't look back. She's got everything she needs. She's an artist, she don't look back. She can take the dark out of the nighttime and paint the daytime black. You will start out standing proud to steal her anything she sees. You will start out standing proud to steal her anything she sees. But you will wind up peeking through her keyhole down upon your knees. Never stumbles, she's got no place to fall. She never stumbles, she's got no place to fall. She's nobody's child, the law can't touch her at all. wears an Egyptian ring. It sparkles before she speaks. She wears an Egyptian ring. It sparkles before she speaks. She's a hypnotist collector. You are a walking antique. Bow down to her on Sunday. Salute her when her birthday comes. Bow down to her on Sunday. Salute her when her birthday comes. For Halloween, buy her a trumpet. And for Christmas, get her a drum.
She Belongs to Me, Bob Dylan, from Subterranean Homesick Blues. Well, thank you very much, Stephen Evans. I have a feeling that you've probably got lots of interesting projects that you have under your fingertips, or at least swimming nearby.
Well, one always has projects, and the big problem is raising the money, getting the cast, and enabling them to happen. But it looks pretty certain now. I'm doing a movie about Severiano Ballesteros, the golfer, and it essentially focuses on his formative years, which not many people really know about. So what would be exciting for me also is that I can get stuck into my lack of knowledge of Spanish classical music, and indeed modern music. So I'm looking forward to that. And the other thing is, which is a very exciting, daunting project, which I've been doing for 2.5 years, is a film of a period of Princess Diana's life with her bodyguard and her private secretary, which some people think will be contentious, but given that it's authentic, I'm optimistic, touch wood.
Well, we look forward to your future offerings, Stephen, whether they're in Spain or nearby here in Kensington Gardens. Stephen Evans, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for inviting me, and I can honestly say it's been a joyous, selfish pleasure.
Stephen Evans was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the artist Tacita Dean. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Sarah Cropper.
On BBC Radio 3.
My name is Harry Wolfe, and this is my story.
An action-packed radio drama in which two warring brothers are forced to come together to fend off a hostile takeover.
Never tell your left hand what your right hand is up to. It's a motto I've followed all my life.
But in the middle of a battle, you should always watch your back.
Gents, I've upped my offer to the shareholders, and it's been accepted.
The Takeover, original British drama on BBC Radio 3. Saturday night in The Wire from 9:30.
And we have a play on Radio 3 this very evening at 8:30. It's called Sunset and it's by Doug Lucy. It's a drama set in Russia in 1984, in which an outspoken Nobel Prize-winning novelist sees his work banned for its critical exploration of the realities of the Soviet Union's involvement in Afghanistan. But an English publisher comes to his rescue. That's our Drama on 3 Sunset this evening at 8:30. That's here on BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. The time now is 1 o'clock, and here's the news with John Shea.
A coach carrying British teenagers home from a school skiing trip in Italy has crashed in northern France, killing a 61-year-old man. The Foreign Office says 4 or 5 other people, including children, were seriously or critically injured. The accident involving the group from Olve Church School in Worcestershire happened in the early hours of this morning. A 47-year-old man is being held in police custody on suspicion of murdering a vicar in South Gloucestershire. Stephen Farrow was arrested early this morning in Folkestone in Kent. The Reverend John Suddards was found stabbed at his vicarage in Thornbury on Tuesday. The Foreign Secretary has warned Iran that it would not benefit from igniting a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, amid claims that the country is preparing to expand its nuclear programme. In an interview with the BBC, William Hague insisted that sanctions and negotiations had to be given a real chance to convince Tehran to abandon its nuclear ambitions. Around 20 people have been killed in two attacks in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. A suicide bomber blew up his car at a checkpoint, killing at least 15 police officers and tribal militiamen. Elsewhere in the city, gunmen, thought to be from Al-Qaeda, stormed a house, killing four police informants. The Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, has called for a temporary cut in VAT to stimulate economic growth. The Conservatives argue that the government has to live within its means and must reduce spending to cut the deficit. Mr. Balls said the government's programme of austerity was crushing and destroying growth. The legendary Sudanese singer Muhammad Usman Wadi has died in Khartoum at the age of 80. He popularised the traditional instruments of his native region of Nubia. Known for his left-wing views, Muhammad Usman Wadi was jailed by the then president, Jafar al-Numeri, in the 1980s and later went into exile. And the weather. It'll be a largely dry and fine afternoon across the UK with lengthy spells of sunshine. However, a few showers will affect coastal fringes of Scotland, Northern Ireland and North Wales. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 2:30 past one.
Read by John Shea. I'm Jill Anderson. Good afternoon to you. Just looking ahead to 2:00, we have a concert given by the BBC National Chorus and Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Jack Van Steen. Sibelius's Tapiola, followed by the Violin Concerto, played by Akiko Suwanae, and Elgar's The Music Makers with the mezzo-soprano Jane Irwin. That's the Sunday concert at 2:00. But now it's time for today's early music show, which today explores the life and work of a much-revered Spanish master. Here's Catherine Bott.
Francisco Guerrero, the meeting of artistry and elegant counterpoint, the rewards of an eternal pen, in the sum of all times, no other reached such heights.
Thank you.
Ensemble Plus Ultra, directed by Michael Noon, with a hymn to the Virgin Mary from 16th century Spain. From my school history lessons, I remember that time being called the Golden Century of Spain, and it was certainly a golden age for Spanish music. The two big names that spring immediately to mind are Tomás Luis de Victoria and Cristóbal de Morales. But in today's early music show, I'm going to take a look at the life and music of the composer whose work makes a bridge between the two, Francisco Guerrero, called the Sweet One, the Beloved of the Infant God, who wrote the music we've just heard, and for whom that tribute at the start of the programme was written. Slightly underrated in later centuries, in his own time, he was the most admired musician in Spain. Although Guerrero spent most of his life in his native land, he was also one of the most widely travelled musicians of the Renaissance, as you'll hear, and despite spending most of his life as a church musician, he wrote a number of secular songs in his not at all misspent youth. In his home city of Seville, they were called villanescas, jolly little ditties.